From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what's next for the petition drive to raise Michigan's minimum wage?
We knew that the Republicans were thinking and planning on ways to sabotage our campaign, but we really didn't think they would go as far as eliminating the minimum wage law.
Flint's Amir Hekmati marks 1,000 days as a prisoner in Iran.
I want to make sure Amir knows that he has his government and his family is with him. Just to keep him psychologically strong, he needs to know that we're fighting for him.
Plus, should Democrats join hands with an unexpected ally?
On an issue-by-issue basis, Democrats and business should be making a concerted effort to work together more.
And it's morel mushroom time in Michigan. We'll find out about that, those stories, and more today on Stateside. Fair game or political trickery? The state Senate has passed a bipartisan bill to increase the state's minimum wage, but the group looking to put the minimum wage question to voters in November is not happy. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we talk to the Raise Michigan campaign about the Republican Senate measure that they call sabotage. And then, have you searched for them yet? Perhaps cooked with them already? Morels are popping up. We'll get the lowdown on where to look for them and how to prepare them. Think lots and lots of butter. That's later this hour. But first, today is the 1,000th day that a Marine veteran from Flint has been held in an Iranian prison. Amir Hekmati was arrested in August 2011 while visiting his grandmother and other relatives in Iran. He was charged with espionage. His initial death sentence was overturned by the Iranian Supreme Court. But there are now reports that Hekmati was secretly retried last December, convicted of, quote, partial collaboration with the American government, and sentenced to 10 years in prison. Congressman Dan Kildee represents the 5th District, which includes Hekmati's hometown of Flint. Congressman, you have been working to free your constituents since you went to Washington in 2013. Did you think then that he would still be in prison after 1,000 days and no sign of release?
Well, we certainly hope that the changes in Iran would have precipitated an earlier release. But, you know, unfortunately, his case seems to be tangled up in this geopolitical struggle between Iran and other nations as they purportedly attempt to rejoin the international community. So we're one of the reasons that we're doing this vigil and all the other activities that we've been involved with is to make sure that the eyes of the world continue to remain focused on this case and that Iran knows that the world is watching.
Tell us about today's vigil.
So we will be at the Lafayette Park, which is right across from the White House. Members of Amir Hekmati's family, a former Marine who doesn't know the family, didn't know Amir, he will be there and is actually standing in a proverbial cell, a mock cell that has been set up there to demonstrate the conditions that Amir is facing. But the main point of all of this is to call attention to the efforts of the U.S. government and the Hekmati family and others around the globe to continue to shine a light on this case. The thing I tend to think about is what would I want my congressman to do if it were my son on the other side of the world being held in a prison. And I think for those listeners out there, that's the way I ask people to think about it. What would we want? What would we do if this was a member of our family?
Well, here we've had President Obama has spoken about Amir Hekmati to the president of Iran. The State Department has been working through its channels. You and other lawmakers have been speaking out and doing what you can, writing letters, pushing the Free Amir campaign. What is left or what might be happening? Is there more going on that we don't know about?
There is a lot of conversation taking place, you know, because we have the so-called P5 plus one nuclear negotiation taking place, which is an effort to deal with Iran's nuclear capabilities. That actually creates an opportunity for some sidebar bilateral discussions between the U.S. and Iran. There are also informal communications taking place. I can tell you that from our perspective, I meet with anybody that we think might be able to have an influence over the decisions that are made by the Iranian government, keeping in mind, of course, that there are no formal diplomatic relations. So we are seeking every channel we can. The hope is, and the reason that we do this, is that Iran will come to the realization that there will be a moment when the credibility of Iran has to be buttressed in some fashion. It has to be validated, that as we continue these discussions with them, they need to show some tangible demonstration that they are serious and that they intend to rejoin the global community. A very tangible demonstration would be the release of Amir Hikmati. And even if they were to do this strictly on humanitarian grounds, it would send a strong message about the position that Iran intends to take in the international community going forward.
Congressman Dan Kildee, on the 1,000th day that former Marine Amir Hikmati from Flint has been held in Iranian prison, and that vigil happens today at the park, Lafayette Park, across from the White House. Thanks so much for talking with us, Congressman Kildee. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Robot vacuum cleaners, self-guided lawnmowers. Wasn't that long ago they seemed like the stuff of science fiction. Now nobody bats an eye at a robot scooting around sucking up dust on the living room floor. So how long will it be before we're getting around in cars that do not need drivers? Well, according to Google, just a few years. The company has developed a prototype, which is apparently now ready for its biggest test, the demands of the city. Stateside's partner, the BBC's Justin Webb, went for a test drive at Google HQ.
We're in California, the sun's shining, we're at Google, and that hum you can hear in the background is a self-driving car. It's a slightly strange-looking thing with a sort of whirling radar-like device on the top, but otherwise it's a perfectly ordinary-looking, rather nice-looking white car. It's got Google on the side of it. It says it's self-driving, and we're going to see whether that's true. Right, we're all in. And we're all ready to go. Let's do some introductions. Our driver first.
Chris Hermson.
And I'm Justin Ono. I'm one of the members of our safety driving team.
I can see already you've got a laptop open on your... What are you doing with that?
I'm monitoring all the car software, making sure that everything's working properly.
And at the moment, then, whenever one of these cars goes out, there is always someone doing your job as well, just monitoring what's happening.
That's correct.
And just to set the scene for people, we're driving on a typical suburban Californian road, so it's nice and straight and easy at the moment, isn't it?
It's a nice little bit of roadway to drive on. And yeah. The car's now told us it's ready to go, okay. So I'm going to press the on button here.
Okay.
And now the car's driving itself.
Whoa, we're off.
Here we go.
Are you doing anything at all?
I'm not doing anything. My hands are away from the steering wheel. I'm not touching the brake or the gas pedal. It's the car's, you know, 10 times a second looking at what's happening around us and then reacting to that and driving safely.
And we've just slightly slowed there because a bus turned across about, I don't know, 50 yards ahead of us, and it just paused, saw the bus. We're going past a cyclist now and just easing. Yes. I felt us ease out into the road, and we're doing now, what, about 40 miles an hour?
35. Speed limit.
Oh. Now we're coming up to a red light.
And the car's coming to a nice slow stop.
Oh, it is. There's no juddering there. That is a better stop than most human drivers I know manage. It's slightly strange to see the steering wheel turning on its own, which it is now as we go around a bend.
What we've really kind of focused on a lot over the last year has been interpreting the world in more depth. So when it's trying to determine whether something's a car or a pedestrian or a tree, it'll look at the shape of the object, it'll look at the size of it, it'll look at how fast they're moving and where they're moving, just like you would. And it's kind of combining all that information together.
Oh, now that really confused it. There were three pedestrians there, weren't there, walking past... A crosswalk.
Turn off auto drive now.
It wants you to take over again. What upset it there?
It just saw the pedestrians coming at us, and we thought that pedestrian might cross in front of us because he was walking on the opposite side of traffic.
Very interesting, that situation, because actually what it did there was almost certainly the safest thing, was it?
but it's
something that I wouldn't have done as a driver. So it may well have rescued the lives of one of those three unsuspecting pedestrians we've just passed. If they had come out, we wouldn't have hit them. If they'd come out and I'd been driving, I think I might have done.
And that tells you a little bit about the philosophy of how we develop the software, right? We build it to be kind of inherently safe, and then we layer on levels of reasoning that allow it to say, okay, well, really the likelihood of that guy stepping into the road is low enough that maybe we should drive past in that case, or at least slow less aggressively.
Yeah. Okay, we're out of the car. You can probably hear the fountains behind us, which means we're in front of Google's headquarters. Can I just address a couple of wider issues with you, Chris? We could have injured someone or killed someone on that trip. It wouldn't necessarily have been our fault. They could have rushed out in front of us. It will happen. Someone will die as a result of a driverless car. Are you confident that what happens next legally is sorted out or can be sorted out?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, America, we have a very robust legal system. And, you know, they'll
got a lot of lawyers, yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of smart people, and they'll be able to look at it. This is their job, right, is figuring out what happened and why and, you know, who, if anyone's at fault. And so we'll get through that part.
The fear will be that the public mood will suddenly change, and instead of people waving at the car and wanting to be photographed with it and all the rest of it, suddenly there'll be a kind of hostility because someone has been killed by a machine, and that changes everything.
I don't think it does, though. People are killed by machines today, right? We have cars on the road, and 33,000 people in America are killed every year. Worldwide, 1.2 million people. And what this technology is doing is making that number smaller because we're eliminating the largest factor, which is human error.
What about the Google side of this? Is your intention eventually that your cars link in with your knowledge of every other aspect of our lives, how we shop, what we look for online, and all the rest of it?
No, this is really about making people safer on the road and allowing them to get from one place to another. We use the data that the car has today to make it safer. This is how we kind of train the algorithm. So each of our vehicles has got about 40 years of driving experience, right? And that comes from them being able to go back and look at how what mistakes they made, what good decisions they made in the past, and make sure they're still making the good ones and not making the mistakes. When it comes to, you know, thinking about what's right for our customers, that's like making the cars safe, and that's what we'll keep doing.
But you are going to know where we go.
Yes.
That's Stateside's partner, the BBC's Justin Webb. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, shroomers, it's your time of year. Mushroom lovers know that in Michigan, May not only brings flowers, it brings delicious morel mushrooms. So that means mushroom hunts are happening all over the state. Many of the hunts will be led by my next guest. Phil Tedeschi is president of the Michigan Mushroom Hunters Club. Welcome, Phil.
Thank you.
Well, how big is morel season to mushroom fans?
I'd say at least a third of our club only hunt morels. The rest of us hunt many other species of mushrooms. Mm-hmm. Up north, it's a big draw for all the small towns, the hotels, the motels up there.
So it's
a big deal.
It is a big deal. What is it about the morel that inspires such passion and love?
First, the flavor. They have tremendous flavor. Also, there's the fact that there is almost nothing else out there at the same time, so there's no worry about picking a deadly mushroom.
Okay.
You don't have to know the mushrooms real well. Just need to learn the three species of morels.
And again, back to that flavor. Describe the flavor.
Oh, a little bit of a nutty taste in there. It is a delicate flavor, I believe, and I think that the people who immediately buy a good steak and fry their morels and have it with the steak are not getting the full flavor of the morel. I think the steak overpowers. So I use with chicken dishes, with fish dishes, with
more
veal
delicate.
Dishes,
okay.
Much more than I would with a strong beef.
Okay, let that flavor really, the flavor really
come through.
Stand.
Yeah.
Now, what is this morel season like in Michigan? Has the winter that we had affected anything?
It probably has to some extent. It is good up north. It should be good up north. The snow cover and the melt is responsible for the water that the mushrooms need. So it could be a very good year. But we're facing the die-off of our ash trees from the ash borer. And the principal forests where folks hunt up north are the ash forests. So it's not going to be as good as it used to be.
And there must be some concern looking ahead as far as the future of our ash trees.
There's definitely concern. Luckily, morels grow with some other trees, so they won't disappear. But like some mushrooms have, there's a boleite that's called the ash boleite that grows only with ash trees. Mm-hmm. It's extinct in Michigan, almost.
When you take people out on a foray, on a mushroom mm-hmm. hunt, tell us what that's like.
The forays for morels, we tend to scatter a lot. Forays for other mushrooms, however, will tend to be more in groups. People will tend to stay around one of our identifiers, folks who know lots of mushrooms and can ID out there in the field and let them know if they've picked a deadly mushroom or a poisonous mushroom.
Put that away right now.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's got to be extremely important. So this is not something one should do without guidance.
No, definitely not. Morel hunting, yes. You can go out for morels. There's just really one mushroom you have to learn not to eat that's out at the same time, and it doesn't look anything like a morel, really. It's a reddish-brown mushroom as opposed to the dark brown of the black morels, the yellow of the yellow or white morels. The half-free morel has a look-alike, but most people can eat that look-alike with no problem.
What do you need in terms of equipment? If someone is listening and has never done this before and says this, you know, they want to step into this the way you did 40 years ago, what do you need equipment-wise?
Okay. The first thing I'm going to say is unusual. It's sturdy boots. I hate to see folks come out summer or spring in flip-flops and shoes like that. We have deer ticks out there. We have lots of mosquitoes. We have lots of poison ivy. And sturdy shoes, long sleeves, long pants are fairly important. Now, as far as gathering, a mesh bag or a basket, baskets are better. There's a myth about spreading the spores of the morels by having them in mesh bags, but it really is a myth. It doesn't help the morels to grow more. A knife to cut. It's better to cut than to pull out from the ground because you could disturb the mycelia, which is the main body of the mushroom, which is underground.
What's the window of opportunity for morel hunting in Michigan?
It can start in mid-April and last into early June, although usually it's a couple of weeks in May.
So we're looking at the big time.
Yeah.
Then what's down the road? What comes next? What other kinds of good mushrooms can you find in Michigan?
Okay, in June there's not very much. We will sometimes pick oyster mushrooms and polypore called the umbrella polypore. In July starts the main summer mushrooms start coming up, the chanterelles, the black trumpets. My favorite eating mushroom is the black trumpet. Mm-hmm. What would almost be heresy to some members of my club is in my top 10 mushrooms, morels are 7 and 8, the white and the black, and the half-frees don't make the list.
What's your favorite way to prepare a morel mushroom?
Every year when I get my first batch of white morels, the larger ones, fleshier mushrooms, I'll cut them off so I can easily stuff them, chop up the stem and the parts of the head that I've cut off, mix that with crab meat and homemade breadcrumbs, stuff the mushrooms, spritz with olive oil, and bake.
Okay, you've got me. That sounds wonderful. Phil Tedeschi is the president of the Michigan Mushroom Hunters. Thanks so much for sharing your passion with us, Phil.
You're welcome.
My name is Chef Herman Seuss from Herman's European Cafe, and I'm cooking fettuccine morellas for you. We had them on the menu for 29 years, and fresh, of course. But 2 teaspoons of unsalted butter, some shallots, and garlic, and we're going to melt them and sauté our morels and our shiitake mushrooms. And then we put the fettuccine, the cream, and the spices. So we soaked our morels in a little salt water, right? To get all the bugs out. I have some shiitakes, a little salt, a little pepper, some thyme, a little parsley, and our fettuccines. And we just cooked. Now, very important. I want you to sauté the morels and the other mushroom in the fettuccine over medium heat in a little bit of unsalted butter so to blend the flavors together, okay? Just for good measure, we have a little more, right? A little more butter. Can you smell it already? All right. Then we got some heavy cream. Heavy cream. A little bit of Worcestershire. We need to let that cook for another minute or two, because I want the cream and the flavor of the morels to stick to the noodles. Now, you have to eat that, you know. I have some takers here already.
I would love to eat that. Thank you so much. That was Chef Herman Seuss cooking up morels in his kitchen at Herman's European Cafe in Cadillac. The story was produced by Tom Carr. When you think of music made in Detroit, you certainly think of Motown. Then there's R&B, gospel, jazz, rock, rap, and there is country.
Sweetheart, I'm tired of roaming and I want to settle down. I'm tired of gallivanting and painting up the town.
The Motor City has a rich, rich history of country and western and bluegrass musicians and clubs, showrooms, and radio stations that really got that music out to an eager public. My next guest tells their story in his new book, Detroit Country Music, Mountaineers, Cowboys, and Rockabillies. Craig Mackey, good to have you with us on Stateside.
Very good to be here. Thank you so much.
So the Grand Ole Opry, kind of what everybody thinks of as that old-timey country music, there were a lot of folks who practiced that kind of music, weren't they, who came to Detroit?
Absolutely. And the Opry represented some of the most famous practitioners of country music. So whatever was going on down there was going on up here in Detroit. Investigating it, I sort of ran into some record collectors who had some music that was made in Detroit, and I had no idea. And I started tracking down some of these fellows, and turned out they had some fascinating stories about their careers in music in Detroit and how Detroit was back in the 1940s and 50s that sort of created an environment that made it favorable for them to practice their music in Detroit.
So what was it that was such a fertile atmosphere in Detroit that made that all possible?
Well, it was mainly the industry that grew up in Detroit and southeastern Michigan during the early 20th century. And so many people from the South came up here, not only at the invitation of the automakers or industrialists, but also family members would call, you know, their cousins or their in-laws to come up and join them. So through the early to mid-20th century, there was a pretty good migration, pretty massive migration. And people came from all over the place. There were people from Oklahoma, Missouri, Arkansas, Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, especially the Appalachian states, what we think of West Virginia, Virginia, and Kentucky.
And I would guess that those folks coming from such a broad area brought a lot of different types of what we might call country music, but there were many subsets, yes?
Yes, absolutely. There were people who actually grew up out west in a cowboy environment that sort of represented the end of the 19th century cowboy experience, who came to Detroit. And I was thinking of Chief Redbird.
Mm-hmm. Chief Redbird being one of the artists you profile in the book.
Yes. And there were people from Appalachia who were sort of before Bill Monroe's generation, Bill Monroe, the king of bluegrass, mm-hmm. and brought their bluegrass music with them. And it's still going pretty strong in southeast Michigan.
And it seems very clear from your book, Detroit Country Music, Craig, that there were no shortage of radio stations that would have artists on regularly. Doesn't happen today, but it did mm-hmm. then. Or showrooms for them to play at. And so it was something where they actually had a way of getting their music out there besides sitting in their living rooms and playing.
Right, absolutely. One fellow I know of came up during the 20s and hired into a Ford factory in Highland Park. And he mainly did house parties, and then he would play cafes once in a while. But then by the late 30s, there was such a demand that nightclubs started and bars started having live music in their rooms.
You also spend quite a bit of time in your book, Detroit Country Music, telling us about Casey Clark and the Lazy Ranch Boys, which the name is just delightful, I have to say.
Yeah, the biggest fiddler in show business. Casey Clark was probably the most popular band leader in Detroit during the 50s. He was on clear channel stations, radio stations. He was on television. He had several disc jockey shows on WJR and as well as WEXL in Royal Oak. And he put on a weekly barn dance in a union hall right near the Chrysler facilities. It was a runaway success for many years up until the recession of 57, 58. And
it had to be right where his people were, right by that Chrysler plant.
Right. And it also was right near a community of people from the South living in Detroit. So it was a very big weekly event that many, many people remember to this day.
I'm speaking with author Craig Mackey about his book, Detroit Country, Mountaineers, Cowboys, and Rockabillies. And let's talk about a few of the many, many artists you profile in your book. And as we do it, we're going to take a listen to their music. We're going to start with the York brothers, George and Leslie York. What made them so special?
They were very popular. Part of it had to do with their personalities. Part of it had to do with their skill as musicians. And they cut a record for a jukebox company in 1939 called Hamtramck Mama. And the flip side was a song called Going Home, which also was something that people from the South could identify with.
Sure. Talk about your truckin' mama, boys, I've got one. She's a Hamtramck baby and she has her fun. She's a Hamtramck mama and she sure does know her stuff. She's the hottest thing in town. Lordy, how she can love.
The Hamtramck Mama proved to be an overnight sensation, so to speak, and it was played in jukeboxes throughout the city, spread to parts of Indiana and Ohio.
And the mayor of Hamtramck did not like it one bit, did he?
No, he didn't. And he tried to get a judge to ban it from the city, and I guess that succeeded in making it more popular.
Well, in fact, that song lived on because as a kid growing up in the 60s, I remember hearing Dick Purton on the old Keener 13 playing that in the mid, I'm going to say around 65. He hauled this funny old song out, and he used to play Hamtramck Mama quite a bit, so it had some legs, didn't it?
Yeah, but I was doing some research in Billboard magazine, and as early as 42... Billboard was reporting on the York Brothers' activities in Detroit, so
they were worth tracking, and they did bounce it back and forth. They did. They were Grand Ole Opry, and then one of them kind of drank himself out of a gig at the Grand Ole Opry, didn't he?
Yeah. It was an unfortunate thing, but fortunate for Detroiters because they came back and spent some time here. In fact, they cut their biggest record while living in Detroit. It was called Tennessee Tango for King Records, but. Yeah, they had an interesting career here because even after they moved to Dallas in 53, they would return during the summers.
So they kept coming back to Detroit. Well, let me ask you this. In your preface, you mentioned Detroit country and rockabilly musician Eddie Jackson. Jackson was the front man for a group called the Swingsters. He's really been a major figure in the Detroit country music scene since the 1940s. I'm curious, what was it that made you want to write this book about Detroit country artists like him and the others?
Well, I think part of the reason was just meeting them and their families and learning about their stories. When I met Eddie Jackson, he kind of took a shine to me, and I would hang out at his house whenever I could. He'd have people over, fellow friends who were musicians, and they'd all just jam. And that's how I started to learn how to play guitar, from learning from these fellas. So,
well, the book is called Detroit Country Music, Mountaineers, Cowboys, and Rockabillies, written by my guest, Craig Mackey. Thank you so much, Craig. It was really fun talking with you.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A bill to raise Michigan's minimum wage from $7.40 an hour to $9.20 an hour by 2017 is now on its way to the State House. This bill would raise the minimum wage for tipped workers from $2.65 to $3.50 an hour. The bill quickly cleared the state Senate late last week by a bipartisan vote of 24 to 14. The bill is an attempt by Republicans to kill a petition drive to raise the minimum wage even higher to $10.10 an hour, even for tipped workers. That petition drive is being led by the group Raise Michigan. Danielle Atkinson with Raise Michigan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what is Raise Michigan going to do now that the Senate has passed this $9.20 an hour bill?
You know, we're just planning. Our plan has not changed. We are going to continue to collect signatures and then turn them in on the deadline.
Did you envision the Republicans coming up with a counterproposal the way they did?
We did. We knew that the Republicans were thinking and planning on ways to sabotage our campaign, but we really didn't think they would go as far as eliminating the minimum wage law.
I know there was much talk and much anger in what was seen as a undemocratic drive by especially Senator Richardville. It was his bill. Tell us why you feel this was so undemocratic.
You know, the Republicans again and again tell Michiganders if they work hard and play by the rules, they can change their destiny. And that's what we did. We came together and said, this is our concern. Raising the minimum wage is something that's a priority to us. And we played by the rules. We collected enough signatures and going to turn them in. And here they are again, changing the rules at the end of the game to win.
But yet we saw many progressive and Democratic allies voting for that Senate bill. I mean, we saw 10 of the 12 Democrats in the Senate joining 14 Republicans in approving the measure. You had names like Gretchen Whitmer and Rebecca Warren and Bert Johnson and others, and even Mark Schauer, Democratic candidate for governor, all supporting the bill. So how do you explain that?
You know, I can only explain it as they were trying to make the best out of a bad situation. But, you know, as the coalition, we just feel like this proposal doesn't go far enough. It doesn't meet the goals of our coalition, and it only strengthens our resolve to continue our campaign.
I spoke with Senate Majority Leader Richardville last Thursday, and I'd like to get your thoughts, a couple of comments that he made. First, there was this comment on your group, Raise Michigan.
Part of the problem is that that group is largely funded outside the state of Michigan. And so here we have people that are not Michiganians, did not vote for elected officials, paying to circulate petitions around Michigan.
Your response?
Well, Senator Richardville does not know me and does not know this coalition. We have all of the groups that are involved in Raise Michigan have roots in Michigan and have been here long before the petition drive has started. I've lived here for at least 10 years, and I'm happy to call myself a Michigander, and this is a concern as a Michigander that I was looking for a solution to.
Is there outside money and support coming in?
You know, like any campaign, we have supporters from all over the country, but again, the groups that are involved have been here since way before this campaign ever started.
I'm speaking with Danielle Atkinson of Raise Michigan. This is the coalition group pulling together to get this petition drive to raise the Michigan minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. Danielle, Senator Richardville expressed some very serious concern about the fact that when a ballot referendum is approved, it's hard, you can't change and tweak the language after the fact, and that can create unforeseen problems. For instance, he pointed to the medical marijuana law that came from a petition drive, and he said he totally supported it, being able to have the patients who need it get the marijuana that gives them relief. But he said the petition language and thus the law didn't address a lot of the issues that are cropping up now, dispensaries and THC concentration and knowing what you're buying. And he felt strongly that your petition doesn't address areas of concern. Here's what he said to us.
A ballot initiative should get our attention. We should work on it. But just by itself, it doesn't address the great array of other problems that can happen. And in this case, we would have severe problems with several segments of our overall economy that are so vital to Michigan. Restaurants is one. Tourism is another. Young people working through summer employment is another. These would not be addressed with that ballot initiative.
And he also asked what happens if the state's economy takes another nosedive and unemployment goes up. So his concern was that the proposal doesn't take that into consideration. What do you say?
you know, Senator Richardville, like every other citizen in Michigan, has a vote, one vote in November. And if he doesn't like the initiative, he can vote no. That's the perfection around a ballot initiative. But what he's doing right now is he is using his power to change the rules mid-game, and that's not fair.
Do you think the proposal language could be too broad?
No, I think the proposal language is exactly what our membership and low-wage workers think needs to be addressed in Michigan. Workers are, two-thirds of them are women, most of them are supporting families, and we need to address that. And tipped employees are a major part of people living underneath poverty. Restaurant workers are two times more likely to live in poverty than the rest of the workforce, and that's what we're talking about.
Can you see any merit to the concerns of, we'll say, restaurant owners who don't see how they can possibly boost the wages of tip workers from that $2.65 an hour all the way up to $10.10? Is there any credence to this possibility that some businesses would be forced to throw in the towel and close, or do you think that's just hyperbole?
You know, I would direct them to the other restaurant workers who are supportive of our initiative. The wages go up 80 in our proposal. It goes up 85 cents a year, very gradually, so people are able to work it into their everyday expenses. And then also, you know, we look at the expenses of restaurants that don't have tipped wages, and it's the same. Their prices are the same. But what they don't have in these other states are the high turnover, because people are more comfortable in their job and they're able to make a living.
Now, the bill that the Senate passed late last week, actually, it sets that minimum wage at a higher level than the one Senator Richardville initially proposed, $9.20 an hour instead of $8.15 an hour. Do you feel like the concerns that you've raised through your ballot initiative helped to get that figure higher?
Yeah, I think the only reason why we are talking about this issue at all is because of the groups and the low-wage workers around Raise Michigan. But you know what this bill doesn't do, even at 920, it still forces taxpayers to continue to subsidize corporations who refuse to pay their employees a decent wage.
How do you think we need to balance the need to help people do better economically in Michigan and the need to keep businesses viable and able to keep hiring people and keep them employed?
You know, we've heard a lot from the Chamber of Commerce and the Restaurant Association, because they have more money to talk to the public about how they think the economy works. And this kind of race to the bottom mentality comes a lot from them. What we say at Raise Michigan, and there's a lot of economists to back us up, is if you put money into the pockets of working families, they are going to help stimulate the economy. It's not just an argument about what's fair for workers. It's also about what's going to drive the economy. And it's low-wage workers, it's middle-income people that drive the economy with their spending.
Now, the attention turns to the State House. What kinds of conversations have you had with House members? What are you hearing from them?
You know, I'm not really having those conversations, because we're so concentrated on just getting the buffer we need to make sure that we qualify. But our members have reached out to us telling us that they're telling them that it's really important to stand up for democracy, that 920 is still not enough. You should trust the voters, let the voters have a say in this. So I know our members are definitely communicating that to their elected officials.
Danielle Atkinson with Raise Michigan. Danielle, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
Should the Democratic Party in Michigan be looking for a new ally, one that's traditionally seen as having closer ties with the GOP? MLive columnist Rick Haglund thinks the answer is yes. He thinks Democrats in Michigan would be wise to join forces with big business. And Mark Brewer, former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, agrees. Mark, Rick, it's so good to have you both with us.
Glad to be here.
Rick, tell me, what led to your conclusion that Democrats and big business have more in common than we might think?
Well, when I was watching what's been going on in Lansing over the past few years, it became apparent to me that the Republican Party, which has always been kind of the party of business, in Michigan has kind of become the party of small business. The legislature has done a lot of things that have helped small business, including the business tax restructuring, in which most small businesses don't even have to file for it anymore. But they've also done a number of things that have been detrimental to big business. The new bridge to Canada, the legislature opposed that, even though most of the major businesses in the state said that it was critical for continued trade with Canada. The legislature has failed to pass adequate road funding. They're talking about more now, but the bigger businesses say we need about $1 billion more a year, in line with what the governor is saying, and the legislature has not gone for that. They've passed right-to-work legislation, which actually could cause some labor management problems with some of the automakers and some of the bigger businesses as time goes on. So I just thought, you know, the Democrats have really been taking it on the chin in Lansing. The Republicans pretty much have had their way, and I thought, you know, the Democrats need some new allies, and many of the things the Democrats stand for, big business is in agreement with them on.
How does that strike you, Mark?
Oh, I think Rick's got it right. I would add a couple of other points to his excellent analysis. A lot of the traditional business advocacy groups, like the State Chamber of Commerce and even the Small Business Association, have frankly become nothing more than arms of the Republican Party. And that's why you see different groups like Business Leaders for Michigan or this ad hoc coalition recently that has said we need to extend anti-discrimination protections to members of the LGBT community,
mm-hmm.
because their traditional advocates are not stepping out on that. I think the other phenomenon you're seeing is that as the Tea Party gets more and more control over the Republican Party in this state and nationally, the Tea Party is not business-friendly. It is not a business-friendly organization or movement. And so for those reasons, in addition to the ones that Rick pointed out, I think there are openings, there are opportunities for Democrats to work with the business community. In addition to what Rick mentioned, the abortion insurance controversy that we've had here in Michigan, I talked to a number of business people who are very uncomfortable with the fact that they now have to talk about abortion insurance with their employees as a separate item, apart from whatever umbrella coverage they might provide. Nationally, we see that Democrats and business are much more closely aligned on immigration reform, while the bulk of the Republican Party, especially the Tea Party wing, is just adamant there should be no reform. So I think Rick is absolutely right. On an issue-by-issue basis, Democrats and business should be making a concerted effort to work together more.
And Rick, your piece from Love, you also point out how, you know, that big business and Democrats are also aligned on more state support for higher education and greater investment in mass transit in cities.
That's right. I think so. They see those issues as being pretty critical to the future prosperity of Michigan. On the other hand, you look at the Republicans that control all of the branches of government. The Republicans in the legislature have, you know, basically been fighting with the universities for a number of years. You know, higher education has almost been a dirty word. Once you get beyond community colleges, they've not shown a lot of support for higher ed, whereas groups like Business Leaders for Michigan are saying, you know, we need probably a million more people over the next 10 or 15 years to have at least a bachelor's degree in this state.
Mark Brewer, doesn't the idea of Democrats reaching out and forming alliances with big business, does that not go against what many expect from the Democratic Party?
Well, I think it does, but I think that also indicates that there's really a stereotype about Democrats, not only in Michigan, but nationally. Look, you know, we are in favor of the economic system that we've got. It creates jobs. It leads to prosperity. And I think we need to kind of break down these stereotypes, break down these walls, because as we've now talked about here, we've made at least half a dozen major issues on which there is common ground between Democrats and business. And instead of all retreating behind our walls and staying behind our walls, we need to try to find common ground on these issues, because it's to the benefit of all the people of Michigan that we do so. And if the Republicans don't want to advance those common interests, Democrats and business should reach out to each other and make sure that happens.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with MLive writer Rick Hagland about his column in MLive, Democrats and Big Business, You Have More in Common Than You Think. And Rick is joined by Mark Brewer, the former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. And I'd like the thoughts of both of you to this question. I guess I'll let you start, Rick, because Mark just spoke. I'm wondering what you think Democrats are missing by not reaching out to big business.
Well, I think, you know, they like the Democratic Party has historically been the party of the working person. It's depended quite a bit on union support for financing its candidates and party activities. Mark could probably speak better to this than me, but it could be that they could be a little gun-shy about getting a little too close to big business and possibly alienating some of their traditional constituencies.
There is some of that, but I think, again, you know, we need to break through these barriers. And for Democrats, I think there are two things here. One, it advances our agenda. We believe in quality education. We believe in a woman's right to choose. We believe in protecting the civil rights of our friends in the LGBT community, and we can make common ground there. And also, as Rick indicated, as we started here, Democrats are winning very few victories in Lansing, and these are some ways to forge some victories and indicate to the people of Michigan that Democrats, you know, still matter, and we can still advance public policy in this state, even though we're in the minority. I mean, there's still going to be a lot of things that keep us apart. There's mm-hmm. no doubt about that. But on those things, we just agree to disagree. And on things where there is common ground, and particularly where we can both advance the interests of all the people of Michigan, we need to set aside those things and not let them block us from working together. I'm glad Rick wrote this column. I think it's an excellent point that's long overdue.
And does it strike you that people are just weary of factionalism and that sense of division, and not a sense of us, but of them, there's us, but not we together?
That's right. And again, I think we're all guilty of that. There's plenty of blame to go around. We all retreat behind our walls and mm-hmm. throw partisan bombs at each other, and sometimes we forget, much of the time we forget, that the goal here is to advance public policy to benefit the entire state. So I hope, as a result of Rick's column and other people thinking about this, that there will be much more reaching across the aisle between Democrats and business to advance some of the topics we've talked about here today.
Well, what would that look like? What does the courting and reaching out, what does that mean to you? What would it look like, Mark?
Well, I think it's at a very much a tactical level. It's simply picking up the phone, either on the business side or on the Democratic side. Maybe it's Democratic legislators. Maybe it's party leaders. There's all kinds of folks who could do that. And you can create ad hoc coalitions, like this coalition that has come together recently to advance LGBT protections. You can form ad hoc issue coalitions, again, agree to disagree on other things, but let's together work on getting this problem solved. And we need much more of that, because we've got such partisan divides. The parties and a lot of the other parts of the political process are increasingly dysfunctional. So I think ad hoc coalitions of like-minded people who agree to work on a particular issue is the way to go.
Mark Brewer is the former chair of Michigan's Democratic Party, and he was joined by MLive columnist writer Rick Haglund. It was great talking to both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you again, Cindy.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Omar Sade, Katie Suha, and Jeff Warniak. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for the Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3:00.